Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Justice, a podcast series exploring all aspects of the criminal justice system with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. In the next part of our procedural justice mini-series, I welcome Jo Millington, who shares her experience as a forensic scientist and explains what really happens when investigating a crime scene. This podcast contains graphic content and is not suitable for children. Some listeners may find some aspects of our conversation distressing.
My name's Jo Millington. I'm a forensic scientist with a particular specialism in bloodstain pattern analysis.
And could you describe to me what you mean by blood pattern analysis? You know, it's a strange sort of line of work to be in, is it not? Maybe not for you.
Well, no, it's my livelihood now. But so BPA, bloodstain pattern analysis, is essentially looking at the pattern of bloodstains that are created as a result of different actions. So if someone is bludgeoned to death using a weapon of type, then the bloodstains that are produced will form a pattern, and those can be interpreted by the way that the stains appear or their association with the crime scene. And that's BPA, basically.
Okay, and what on earth led you to this career? What was the trajectory?
You'll never open a newspaper and it's a, here, there's a job in BPA. It's kind of an area of forensic science that you specialise in. So, for example, when you start out a career as a forensic scientist, typically you are either a biologist or a chemist. And for my particular journey was as a biologist, and then I started to specialise. And when I did my initial training, I did some research out with Miami-Dade Police. And in Miami, there was a guy there who is kind of a BPA specialist. He's an expert. He's been around for a number of years. And he essentially said to me, "Joe, if you make anything of yourself, come back and see whether or not you'd like to do my BPA training course." So anyway, a few years later, I managed to get a job, my first job with Lothian and Borders Police. And it got to the point in my training where I needed BPA training. And I rang the guy in Miami and I said, "Look, I'm ready for the course." And he said, "Wow, who are you?" No, he didn't. So he said, "Joe, come on the course." So I did the training course with him. He's the advisor to Dexter, actually, which is quite a famous bloodstain pattern expert on the telly. But anyway, so I did my training with him and I was kind of sort of bitten from that point onwards, really. So the rest of my career, I made choices that allowed me to specialise in bloodstains. So that included sort of taking specialist courses and such like. And now I train others, which, you know, is kind of full circle, really.
Right. So if someone wanted to go into the line of work that you're in BPA in particular, they would have to train to be and do a degree or a you know, what hoops do you need to jump through in order to get to sort of where you are?
Yeah, well, the standard career path really is to do an undergraduate degree. I did one in biology, and then I chose to do a Master of Science in Forensic Science, although that's not absolutely necessary. It was just because I'm quite an academic person, so that fit really with my kind of what I'd like to do. And then beyond that, then I applied for a job as a forensic biologist. forensic biology in particular involves kind of DNA and body fluid analysis. And as you start to sort of build up your expertise, then you kind of progress into crime scene examination. So that would be going out to the initial crime scene to examine it for different evidence types. And obviously blood is a major part of that, because typically a scientist will be called to attend a scene if there has been a violent crime. So BPA became something that I was kind of starting to sort of move towards, because I was a crime scene attending scientist effectively.
And what is it exactly that blood can tell you? Because I guess you turn up at a crime scene, let's use an obvious one like murder, you know, you're looking for the sort of the story and the narrative around what's happened, aren't you? And I know you've been one of a team of people trying to put the pieces of the jigsaw together, but can you try and explain to us exactly, as you enter the crime scene, what you do?
So if I'm called to a crime scene, then usually I'm there with a view to looking at the bloodstains that are present. And you're absolutely right, I'll be working as part of a team, but I won't necessarily be working with that team, because they'll all have their own independent kind of reasons for being there, whether it's footwear or fingerprints or whatever. So my job really is I'll be given some information from the crime scene manager who's in charge of the scene. They might give me a little bit about the circumstances or activities that might have happened there, for example, if paramedics are attended or something like that, or things that might impact on my assessment. And then I'm kind of left to my own devices, really, because my view then is to take a kind of broad brush look at the blood that's present, but then to start to break it down into its different elements. So I might start where the body is and have a look at the blood staining around that individual, but then I'm starting to try and get a kind of a feel for how the blood is distributed in relation to that individual, or whether or not there is any independent areas that need inspection. So it might suggest that an assault started somewhere else and then move to where the body's been found. So it's kind of, it is a narrative in terms of actions that may have taken place at the crime scene. So you're almost reenacting from the blood someone's perhaps last movements, last actions, how they've interacted with other individuals, whether people have moved things, whether things have been moved. And it can give you a really, oftentimes can give you a really good reconstruction of sort of that, those last moments, actually.
And of course, there's, you know, what's so interesting, and when I first met you and you were describing what you did, was that it was something I'd never really thought about before, because why would one, really? but it's sort of, you know, how you described the actual pattern of the blood. So whether it's dripped or splashed or projected, and you can tell the different types of impact, as you say, whether someone's been bludgeoned or sliced. And apologies if this is gruesome for our listeners, but I think it's really important to, you know, to go there because it's so interesting. But can you explain a bit more then about, you know, how you learn whether something is dripped or splashed, or, you know, how you pull that out? And then do you get a ruler out and sort of say, well, this bit is about, you know, 10 centimetres away from this bit? And
well, you essentially do. I mean, there's a huge criticism of BPA, actually, and it's slightly false, is that it's quite like a magic art. So it's very subjective and it's just about looking at patterns and giving an opinion. But actually, it's underpinned by quite an extensive science in terms of measuring and predicting how blood behaves once it leaves the body. I mean, well, we've got a circulatory system that is, like, you know, precisely engineered so that blood stays in the body and just circulates around us and delivers oxygen. As soon as we're injured, then that injury can lead to the production of bloodstain patterns. Now, how we interact with the blood after it's left the body will produce very specific types of patterns. If I deliver a blow into wet blood, what I do is I disperse that blood as little droplets. We call it blood spatter. And those droplets sort of travel through the air in a relatively predictable way. So blood is quite lazy. It follows the path of least resistance. If you've, imagine yourself, if you've got kids and it's raining and you all put your Wellington boots on and then you go out and the kid jumps in a puddle, that water is going to get splashed and dispersed onto anybody other than the person jumping in the puddle, right? So blood's exactly the same. So if I impact into wet blood by delivering a blow or whatever, then that will create blood droplets which are dispersed around that area of attack. Those droplets then produce relatively predictable patterns, and it's the association between those droplets, the size of the droplets which we can use to indicate the force that's been applied, the alignment of droplets with respect to each other to indicate whether or not they're kind of radiating out and been dispersed quite randomly, or whether those drops are all in a line. Those observations can be used to try and determine the actions that caused the droplets to be produced in the first place. So if I bludgeon someone to death pretty viciously, multiple impacts into wet blood and there's tissue and things and blood starting to flow, that will create very spectacular impact patterns. If I have a weapon that is being swung through the air and it's blooded, then droplets of blood can leave that weapon in a line and they create a linear pattern on the wall, and that's called cast-off patterns. And so each of these different features can lead you to sort of give an opinion as to how blood was deposited. And that then in activity, sort of in an activity sense, tells us that people have been bludgeoned to death multiple times, or weapons have been swung, and the position of individuals when that weapon was swung. So you can start to sort of pull all that information, those measurements, those observations, and sort of pull them back into a story about how the blood was created.
Right. And I imagine, you know, if there's blood on the ceiling, for example, you know, I'm not sure what that tells you, but I imagine sort of high impact and a sort of rather vicious attack or not.
Yeah. So arterial damage injuries can create really spectacular patterns. And I know they're horrendous and horrific to think about, but from a bloodstain pattern analyst point of view, projected blood from an artery is like the best thing since sliced bread. So basically, once the artery is breached, then you no longer need to interact with it, that individual, in order to create a pattern. So as soon as the artery is damaged, you can kind of step back and the pattern will produce on its own. So the blood sort of is projected out of the circulatory system under the pressure of the heart and the heartbeat, and it pulses out of that system as a column of blood. That column of blood then breaks up into individual droplets, and those droplets are projected onto various surfaces. Now, if there's nothing around you and that column of blood breaks up into droplets, you can effectively get what we call arterial rain, and it literally will sound like raindrops on a window. It's absolutely catastrophic in terms of the injury, but the patterns that are produced are exceptionally diagnostic.
Okay.
So that pressure within your circulatory system, as your blood volume starts to reduce, the pressure starts to also decrease. And so eventually you'll get to a point where there isn't enough pressure to project the blood any significant distance. And all of that is reflected in the pattern, which is why our observations and our eyes are kind of the most important tool, really, for a BPA scientist.
Okay. Are you always physically at the crime scene, or do you get shown photographs as well?
A bit of both, really. I mean, the ideal is to be called to the crime scene, because it's there where you get more of the picture. So it's like the more removed you are from a crime scene, the less information is available to you. It's like as soon as you take the jigsaw pieces out of the box, if you put the box to one side, then you haven't got a guide as to how to put those pieces together. So the scene is like the box and the picture on the front of it. So if you've got that, you're always going to be in a better position to give a more kind of holistic, complete view on something. If you've got an individual in an assault situation and they're punching someone or kicking someone, if they only catch part of the blood that's available at that moment, then you're always dealing with like less information than you'd like. We call it partial pattern capture, because it might be that their arm goes into the impact site when they punch and they collect some blood on their sleeve. But as soon as they withdraw their arm, then they're taking that out of the blood environment. So it means that you're always, if you're not at the crime scene, then you don't have all of their clothing or the whole picture, then you're always trying to sort of fill in the gaps a little bit. And as soon as in forensic science you start to try and fill in gaps, you're opening yourself up to risk, because you might fill the gap with something that is a complete red herring, or you might fill the gap with something that you learned on a previous experience. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean it applies to this experience, because this experience is completely unique, really. So the scene is definitely where you're going to get the most out of me, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I can't do my job by looking at other people's notes, if they've made good notes, or if they've been taking photographs. And, you know, if there's a good record, then you can get a certain amount of information from it. You perhaps just need to caveat it a little bit and say, just be a bit careful here.
And I guess also you're looking for how many people might have been present at a crime scene, because if we stay on the, okay, one person's been murdered, but if there's been a big fight, might you find the blood of multiple people, which obviously then helps the investigation? And the other question would be, is it part of your job to test the different types of blood to differentiate between people?
Yeah. So if other people are injured in a crime scene, then to me, that's my focus. Because, I mean, I've had a number of cases where the amount of blood might be on the extreme. So, you know, you've got huge quantities of blood staining, which could take days, weeks, months, perhaps, to interpret every minute detail of it. But if there is something in that kind of blood environment that doesn't fit with the blood having come from the injured party or the victim, then that could lead investigatively to leads for the police. So if someone else has been injured, if they've cut themselves or they've been involved in a fight which has then progressed into the murder, then obviously if you can pick out their blood amongst these masses of blood staining, then that's going to be useful. So oftentimes,
but that must be quite challenging, right? Because I mean, everyone's blood is red, so where would you even begin to be like, oh, we'll test this blood because it might be different? Do you see what I mean? If it's just a chaotic crime scene of just red.
Yeah, so I'll give you an example of a scene that I once went to where this chap, he'd been bludgeoned to death. So the weapon was a baseball bat, and the injuries were horrific, frankly. But so in the hallway of this house where he lived, there was a huge quantity of blood stains, impact spatter and cast off and all kinds of things. But leading beyond that was a trail of blood drops. These were sort of small circles on the ground. It was a wooden floor. So they were just a little trail of drips. And then it stopped. And then as you went further into the house, the trail of drips restarted. And in areas where there were cupboards and drawers, you could see that there was really small amounts of blood on the handles and such like. And underneath those handles of the drawer in particular, there was a little cluster of droplets. And so those were absolutely sort of incongruous with the rest of the scene, because they looked like someone with an injury had been kind of moving around, and maybe they'd staunch the blood flow. And then when they'd start to do activities such as going in the drawers and having a little rake around, their injury had reopened and they'd started to re-drip blood from those injuries. Anyway, it turned out that blood was the blood of the assailant. So during the assault, they'd become injured. And then they'd gone around the house and they were looking for valuables and bits and bobs. They were there because they were robbing the place. But of course, then this attack had sort of become part of it, and probably wasn't planned necessarily, but it had developed into the assault of this gentleman. The case was really sad, actually, because they worked out that this guy stole about, I think it was about £27 or something. I can't remember the precise figure, but it was such a small amount of money for, you know, this catastrophic ending to this life. And the guy was seen, he left the apartment and then he was seen on CCTV and he wandered a couple of doors down from the apartment and he went into a fish and chip shop and they had a slot machine and he put all £27 back into this slot machine and lost it all. So within seconds of, you know, killing this guy and getting this small amount of money for nothing, it was all over. It's horrendous, isn't it?
Really horrendous.
Like I say, the drops of blood were so important in that scene, even though the crime scene manager was kind of like, Joe, you know, shouldn't you be concentrating on this large amount of blood in the hallway? And I was like, hang on a second, I think we've got something completely different here. You know, and we swabbed it and took it for DNA.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. I was wondering whether you get that a lot with people sort of, you know, not trying to tell you how to do your job, but it's like, oh, look, there's lots of blood over there. You should be over there. It was quite interesting you said that when it's like, well, actually, I'm sort of trained in doing this. And actually, that's the obvious thing to do, isn't it?
I don't mind being told what to do because actually, you know, they know more about the scene than I do when I arrive. So if they say, look, we'd like you to look at this particular area, then fair enough. But at the end of the day, I will sort of say to people, can you just leave me to it for 10 minutes? Because, you know, I mean, if you can ask me lots of questions, that's not a problem, but I can't give you any sensible answers to those until I've got my head around what we're dealing with. So the best way for me to do that is for you just to sort of leave me to it and let me just collect my thoughts and get my head around it, because I don't want to be prejudiced by your ideas on it as much as I don't want to be prejudiced by my own. I have to be really careful to sort of know that my approach is as unprejudiced by other things that I've experienced as possible. And the management of bias is a really important part of our approach. So if somebody says, oh, we think this is the murder weapon and hands me a frying pan with blood on it, then that immediately is going to go into my brain as though, all right, well, that's the murder weapon. So I'm now, that's influencing my, potentially influencing how I look at the patterns, because I'm thinking, oh, that could be from a frying pan. Whereas if I don't have that information to start with and I go in with a completely open mind that's not been kind of tainted by any preconceptions, then it probably allows me the best chance to do as much as I can, as objectively as I can, and then answer their questions, you know, when I'm ready.
Yeah, and I was just wondering, because I was thinking about that sort of managing the bias, because I imagine also that in crime scenes, some can be sort of very organized and some can be disorganized crime scenes, and I imagine that some perpetrators would be trying to cover their tracks and also trying to throw investigators off the scent.
Well the first thing that happens when you, not from personal experience, but the first thing that happens when you kill people and they bleed excessively is it creates a complete mess. You know, so if you're involved in an assault where you might not have quite thought it through, suddenly you're left with an enormous pool of blood on your carpet or wherever. So a lot of people's immediate reaction is, I really do need to clean this up. So, you know, that leads to all kinds of bizarre activities to try and clean blood up. So they might move furniture and try and mask it. They might get the bleach out and think, right, I need to really clean this out. They might burn the house down. There are lots of actions that people undertake to try and cover their tracks. So the very start of a crime scene has to be expect the unexpected. I went to a scene not that long ago, actually, where on the stairs on the way up to this flat, there was some sort of discarded clothing. And this is after the scene had been effectively processed by the police. So they'd recovered their initial items, and you know, these things were just there because they were part of the kind of the fabric of the scene, really, rather than necessarily suspicious in the context of the crime. I was kind of, you know, I asked the crisis manager, do you want me to put those to one side? And he said, oh, no, we're happy that those are just part of the sort of the general laundry or whatever of the scene. But I had a look at it and it included a pair of socks. And on the outside of the socks, there didn't appear to be any, or the visible side of the socks, there didn't appear to be any blood. But when I looked inside the sock, there was blood staining, and it didn't really make sense that there should be blood on the inside, as you could see. And it turned out they were inside out, and it looked as though somebody had had these socks on their hands. So I had a look at it and turned around. It looked like they'd been worn as a glove. So these have been discounted as just being sort of discarded items, you know, end of the day, coming from work, take your shoes and socks off and just leave them on the stairs, as you may do. But in actual fact, they were completely integral to the scene. So they were recovered, and the outside, as in the stuff, the side we could see, was the side that would have been next to the skin. So that's the side that we need to target for DNA, effectively, because if somebody's worn them as gloves on their hand, then their DNA could be on the bit that they've sort of been in contact with. And that's exactly what happened. They were examined, and the samples recovered from what would have been the inside, and there was a DNA profile that matched somebody on the National DNA database and identified the assailant. So it, you know, your kind of your view on it has to be completely open, because you're expecting the unexpected. It's weird.
And stupid question alert, I've got lots of them. When you're trying to recover the DNA of a person, because I know that, you know, often people will either break into houses with gloves on, and I presume they do that to avoid leaving fingerprints, but is DNA only recovered from parts of the body? Is it blood and hair and bodily fluid?
In terms of transferring DNA, you can transfer DNA in lots of different ways. So we're constantly shedding DNA, essentially. So if we touch something, depending on time of day and our shedder capability, we could leave DNA, or we might not leave DNA. Just depends on the circumstances. And the transfer of DNA is a really kind of hot topic, really. I suppose we don't really understand the limits of it quite yet, but it's possible that you could leave traces of DNA just simply from handling something. So if you're wearing gloves because you think that that's going to protect you from being identified in a crime scene, think again, because it might not, you might not leave your fingerprint, but if you've been touching your face and you've got DNA on the outside of the gloves, then you could be effectively transferring that DNA to the surfaces. Equally, you could be transferring DNA from somebody else onto surfaces. Right. So, you know, from your partner or from people in your household, or, you know, DNA is such a kind of ethereal thing that we can transfer it without really knowing that. So it's quite a difficult thing to interpret.
And that must be difficult then at a crime scene, because if it's someone's house, then you'd be picking up DNA, I guess, of lots of different people who've been there over the course of weeks and months.
I mean, it can persist really almost indefinitely. I'm not going to say it will just last forever, but just depending on what vehicle it's in. So if you've, you know, we can recover DNA from submerged bodies, for example. So we know that it can persist through pretty inhospitable environments. So just day-to-day activity, then you've got to expect that it can be there for some time.
And can you age blood? Because I imagine if you go to a crime scene, it's quite recent and you're sort of looking at it and it's all quite new, but can you age it, and can you work out how long blood's been there?
No, you can't. I mean, it's a fallacy that you can age it, because some people say as it ages, it starts to discolour and turn a browner colour. But actually, if I deposit blood on a radiator, or I mix some detergent with it or something like that, I can cause it to change colour, and it's relatively fresh. So colour is a really difficult indicator. I will say that it's usually really fresh if it's still in liquid form. So if it's still wet, that's telling you that it's pretty recently deposited. Saying that, if we have large volumes of blood and maybe it's been deposited on plastic or something like that, it can stay in liquid form for sometimes days. I can attend scenes and I might maybe move a carrier bag or something, and underneath there is sort of wet, sticky blood. And I know it's not been freshly deposited because the crime scene's been, you know, under police control for a number of days, and I've not attended until maybe day two or three. So it just depends on the conditions and the environment, really.
And how do you, out of interest on a sort of personal level, how do you, or how did you in the earlier parts of your career prepare yourself for your first real crime scene? Because I've always wondered about that, because I imagine when you're studying, you're, you know, people will mock up crime scenes and you're learning through the classroom. Well, how does anyone prepare you for your first murder crime scene, for example?
I'm not sure I can remember any preparation. I know that sounds absolutely horrendous, but the thing is that I think if you're so sort of motivated by maybe the science or the approach or the job, you start to sort of focus on that rather than maybe the other aspects of it.
You're almost detached. You're sort of just looking at it from a sort of AB professional, how do I solve this?
I think I am, and I hope that doesn't sound like really... really harsh or arrogant, because I've never really felt personally that I'm affected by these scenes, even though I know that I've seen some pretty horrendous, you know, scenes. I mean, some of the cases have been, when you think about it, you think, crikey, that's horrific. And if I see programs on the telly where somebody is injured, or you know, there's some sort of depiction of somebody being injured, I can get quite squeamish. So it really is a bit of an odd thing that I could go to a scene where maybe, you know, somebody's head's been chopped off or they've been dismembered or, you know, things like that, and I don't recall being upset by it or squeamish about it. So I think it must just be the process of it that kind of takes over my brain and I focus in on that, really. I will say that, and again, it sounds really contrived when you say it out loud, but I always sort of give a nod to, if there's a victim there, I will always say, you know, not out loud, but just give a recognition that I'll do my best kind of thing, and just try and give them a nod that, you know, I will work it out if I can. And I don't know whether that's just part of a process that is, for me, makes me feel better. I don't know where it came from. It just seems something that I feel I should do that, mm-hmm. You know. But I've done a few scenes where animals are injured. And again, it's going to sound really odd that affects me more than if there's an individual there. And it, you know, you kind of think, what a weirdo. If I see a dog, or, you know, especially if an animal has been sort of encapsulated in the violence, you know, because people use animals to kind of threaten, or, you know, in abuse situations. So there are situations where an animal might have been, you know, mistreated or has been killed as part of the assault. That sometimes makes me a little bit more upset than perhaps looking at an individual that's, you know, been really horrendously mutilated. And it's weird, that, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, let's be honest, the whole topic's quite weird. So, you know, I don't know what's I mean, it's fascinating. And actually, how I was going to ask about the animals, how often do you see that? Because again, that's not really something I guess I'd sort of thought a huge amount about.
No, I mean, it's not commonplace, but it's certainly not uncommon either. I mean, the thing about pets is that they're usually pretty controlled in a scene. So that means that, you know, if something horrendous goes on, like there's a fire set or something like that, then pets can become kind of inadvertently caught up in that, can't they? And they might become overcome by smoke or whatever. So
I guess I had heard about it, particularly with domestic violence and stalking.
Yeah.
You know, leaving a dead cat on the doorstep, or sort of horrific thing to think about, in a way of sort of trying to terrorize
that emotional kind of approach to violence. And you know, I mean, it's pretty horrific, but equally like I say, I've had cases where, you know, people have been dismembered and packaged up into little bags and put in freezers. And I had a guy once, and he sort of fried up the brain of his victim, and he was, you know, and you think, crikey, these are very, you know, extreme circumstances to be involved with. But yeah, at the end of the day, the job is just to find out who did it, what happened, and be as robust as you can in terms of presenting your evidence, really.
Yeah, and on that note, because obviously the blood pattern analysis, as we talked about, is sort of one chunk of a big job. So where does the criminal profiling come, just go alongside that? Or where do you fit into the big picture?
Yeah, so a part of an investigation. I mean, if you think about if there's some sort of incident has taken place, then there'll be different priorities to investigate in that particular situation. If there's been blood spilled, then obviously BPA will probably become part of that kind of environment. But my role is kind of to support and to collaborate with the rest of the people involved. So if, for example, I'm looking at a pattern, I might say, well, we need a number of samples from this particular area or this distribution of bloodstains. Those samples will then go off for DNA analysis. So I'm then working with a DNA scientist who will generate profiles from them. And then that comes back into the sort of the main river or the stream of forensic thinking. And everything is kind of building up a picture. So it's definitely not just me doing my thing in isolation. You have to collaborate with everybody else to try and sort of reassess priorities, define the best strategy, because it might be that I go thinking, I'm going to solve this. And the pathologist is there thinking, this is my ticket, you know. And so, you know, and it might be that there's a case where I go and I'm like, do you know what? I can't really help you much here. I can tell you about the blood patterns, but actually your main aim should be the footwear marks or the fingerprints, or, you know. So my job's as much about stepping back as it is as stepping up, really, because yeah, there's no point in me going, you know, I'm brilliant and I'm going to solve this, because at the end of the day, it's a big team that with a limited budget usually, so you've got to prioritize it, you know, sensibly.
So it sounds like there's a bit of competitiveness then, sort of within the crime scene investigation, is that it's like, right, the pathologist is like, I'm going to get this one, and then you come in, you're like, I want to be the one to solve this one, and then you've maybe got the profiler who is that goes on, or is it kind of obviously professional competitiveness where you...
Oh yeah, of course it's professional competitiveness, but, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, it's really annoying when the pathologist solves it. You kind of want to be it, don't you? Of course you do. But yeah. No, I mean, at the end of the day, the job is to recover evidence and present that to the jury, to the court, effectively. So, you know, a little bit of banter it goes a long way, I think. But I think that the most powerful cases that I've been involved with have been those where we've had kind of cross-disciplinary collaboration. Because at the end of the day, if you can work together and get an outcome that is going to be stronger than just one sort of seam of evidence driving the case forward. And also, at the start of an investigation, you never know the other side of the story. So when you're called to a scene and the police say, you know, there's been a murder, of course they don't say that, but there's been a murder, you go to the scene, then the job is to find out who the murderer is. Now, when the suspect or the alleged perpetrator is identified, they've got an account that needs to be evaluated. You know, they might say, well, I didn't kill that individual, I didn't beat that individual, I didn't kick that person, but I did deliver first aid and try and resuscitate. So, you know, we now need to look at their side of things and to try and evaluate whether bloodstaining on them is more in keeping with them having bludgeoned somebody to death, or whether their account, them delivering first aid, is perfectly reasonable. You know, so when you're driven at the start of an investigation, you're in a different mindset to where you are at the end of an investigation, which is more evaluating the evidence in light of the accounts that are available. And that really is the golden ticket for a forensic scientist.
Right. And that must get complicated when the perpetrator, so take domestic violence, the perpetrator is attacking someone, and in self-defense, they never saw it coming, but, you know, they are being attacked and they end up killing the person who is trying to harm them.
Yeah.
And of course, they probably want to flee the scene because then they have done something terrible that they never thought they'd do, but they had to do it in order to save their own lives.
Yeah, it's very difficult to address self-defense from a forensic point of view, from certainly my point of view, because, you know, the opportunity for blood transfer, if you're admitting to having been involved in an assault with someone, is the same whether you're working in self-defense or whether you're working in as an aggressor. Similarly, I can't address consent, you know, so in a sexual assault case. So there are limits to what we can do. And I think it's really important to kind of outline those from the start. So, you know, I'm not a magic brush that can just kind of go over a case and say, right, that's that sorted. There'll always be a scale of kind of evaluation, and there'll be some cases where I can discount almost entirely somebody's account, and there'll be cases where it's absolutely impossible to split apart, you know, the allegation versus the defense alternative, and there'll be some cases where everything in the defense alternative is entirely correct, and I'll support the defense. And it's not a case of going in saying, right, I am a prosecution scientist, I just have to utterly evaluate based on the information that's available at the time.
And do you always get told at the end of a case, because you come in and you sort of have a look at the blood spatter and give your expert advice, do you always get told when someone has been convicted? Do you follow the case the whole way through, or do you sometimes not?
No, sometimes I'll never hear about it again. I mean, I will give evidence quite frequently, just simply because of the nature of the casework that I do now. I do go to court quite a lot compared to perhaps when I was a more junior kind of RO reporting officer. But now sometimes I'll leave the court having given evidence and I'll hear nothing about it from that moment on. Sometimes they're in the newspaper and, you know, maybe somebody will send me a link and say, is this the case you were working on or something like that? And I'll be like, all right, yeah, there you go. But at the end of the day, that's kind of not my job. Of course, I've got an interest in it, but my job is not whether or not they're guilty or not. It's kind of just providing a kind of a snapshot on what the science means at the time.
Mm. And I'm also interested, going back to sort of how on an individual and personal level you cope with your job. So you come home from work, you've seen something really disturbing, and, you know, you sit down with your family or friends, and do you feel there's a bit of responsibility actually to not tell them exactly what you've seen, because actually it's quite normalized to you? Because I certainly know I do that with my line of work, and you kind of like blah blah blah, and you sort of say it off the cuff and you think, god, that was actually quite irresponsible, because they're maybe the people you're talking to just aren't equipped to be able to hear some of the things that you see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't tend to talk about cases. I mean, certainly not when they're live and ongoing, because there's a responsibility not to.
Do you have close friends that, obviously, I'm sure you've got lots of colleagues that you can have a real kind of chat, a gruesome chat with them about it, and a kind of off-road?
Yeah, so there are two aspects, because whenever I come back from a crime scene, or having done any kind of interpretation, I've got a responsibility to make sure that that's right or wrong. So we do a debrief. So it means that I'll sit down with a colleague and I'll talk through my findings and show them photographs and say, oh, look at this, and what did you think about this, and all that kind of stuff. And at the end of it, you know, we'll come to some sort of agreed opinion on it. The very end of that process really is, are there any health and welfare sort of issues? So there's an opportunity then to say, well, do you know what? I didn't like that part of it. So, you know, maybe chat to somebody or whatever. That's one side of it. And then when I come home and I'll say, right, oh my goodness, I went to this scene today. It was absolutely incredible. There was an X you know, an arterial pattern, you know, you don't see them very often. It was amazing. then usually what happens is everybody at home says, what are we having for our tea?
Yeah, exactly. Gosh, I'm just a bit busy right now. So yeah. Later.
And they're in absolutely no way interested. Yeah. You know, so it's kind of like, oh, okay, well, fair enough. But I think you've got to be kind of realistic, don't you? You know, at the end of the day, nobody wants to hear about somebody else's job.
Yeah, exactly. I, you know, it's when people talk to me about sort of hedge funds and stuff, and I'm just like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I can't process it in my mind what you're on about.
The thing that happens to me quite a lot is people will say, oh, did you see so-and-so on the television? There was some blood in it. What did you think? And I'd be like, well, I didn't see it. Or, you know, I did see it and I thought it was completely unrealistic or whatever it might be. But yeah. So people tend to talk about television shows more than they do, you know, actual crime scenes, I guess, and get my opinion on that.
Yeah. And so if anyone's listening and they actually have an interest in becoming a forensic scientist or, you know, getting into the line of work that you do, I know you love your job. So I'm not even going to ask that question, but would you sort of encourage more people to come forward to become blood pattern analysts? Is it a job that we need more young up and coming people to go into?
Oh, 100%. You need up and coming people to come into all kinds of professions, don't you? But I mean, the thing is that I don't know whether people remember this, but there was a program called Indelible Evidence and Ludovic Kennedy presented it. It was probably in the 80s, I think. Anyway, I was a kid then, but me and my mum watched this program and it was about forensic science. And in fact, it was almost like iconic cases of the time. And he looked at how forensic science could help to solve these cases. And I don't know what it is about those programs, but they kind of stuck in my mind. And from that moment on, I wanted to be a forensic scientist. So my parents had to go to school and sort of allow me to do three sciences at, you know, at school and as options and stuff. So it was really weird how sort of single-minded I was about it, and it just, as it happened, worked out that I quite enjoy what I do.
Yeah.
Can you imagine doing all that training and education and then getting to be a forensic scientist and going, oh my goodness, I don't actually enjoy this at all. But anyway,
I'm suddenly a bit squeamish and I don't
So I don't know whether or not people are so driven in terms of their career choices. Perhaps they are, and I'm sure that there are a number of people that just think, do you know what, I want to be a forensic scientist. All I will say is that it is really competitive to get into now. I mean, when I was applying for jobs, you know, there was like tens, maybe even 100 people applied for the same job at the start, and now there could be several hundreds, you know, of applicants for a particular position. So it is really competitive. How do you get into being a forensic scientist? Well, you just have to kind of plug at it and hope that you get a lucky break. I often say it's better to be lucky than good, actually. What I will say is that at every step of your sort of decision making, you need to try and do things that you enjoy. Because at the end of the day, you know, if you do a degree in forensic science because you think that's going to get me a job, but you actually only enjoy biology, or, you know, you're not a chemist or something like that, I would tend to move you and say maybe consider doing a biology degree rather than necessarily focusing on forensics, because then you get that kind of background and foundation that you can use in other areas. Because like I say, you will never open a newspaper and see a job advert saying BPA scientist wanted.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, when I finished university, I went to the job centre to find a forensic scientist job. And they had an old directory in those days. It was in like a lever arch file, the jobs that are available. And they opened the folder for me to look for forensic scientist jobs under P. Because they thought it began with PH.
Okay.
So, you know, so kind of like it was not heard of then, but now it's so in the psyche of us from, you know, Silent Witness and CSI and Dexter. There's such a huge sort of draw to it, but it's a really, really competitive field.
And I think it's so interesting what you said about carry on doing what you think you enjoy, because certainly throughout my career, and I'm lucky enough to have found my passion and I work in the area that I'm passionate about, as do you. When I first met you, I thought, my God, this is a really gruesome subject, and that woman really enjoys talking about blood. And you can't really fake that, can you? You know, you meet so many people throughout your working life, and you know, some people are just so electrified by what they do, and if you're lucky enough to be a person who has stumbled across that, then yeah.
I mean, what are the chances, really? Like I say, it was this guy in Miami who said, you know, if you want to take the course, come back and do the course. And I mean, you know, now I deliver training to people from all over the world. I mean, I'm just so fortunate, and I just think, crikey. And when I came down to London, so I worked in with the Forensic Science Service in London, and my arrival there coincided with the guy who was lead bloodstain pattern scientist, and he was sort of moving towards retirement, and again, you know, I just kind of on his coattails, I sort of, he pulled me through, and he handed me, he gave me his training materials and sort of handed over the baton a little bit, and you know, and then I took his training materials and I develop them a little bit, and now I sort of, you know, deliver those again, you know, to lots of different people. And I just thought, you know, the timing of that, you know, and this guy, you know, I'd read newspaper articles where he'd been involved in, you know, these really infamous cases, and so then to be sort of sat opposite him and being, you know, coached and mentored by him, it's just astonishing, really. I can't get over how fortunate I've been. So when people ring me or email me and say, look, I'm really interested in BPA and, you know, I really want to get into it, then if I've got a spot on my course, you know, I will do everything I can to put them on it, because I just think, you know, that little inkling of a chance that I had years ago, and suddenly I'm, you know, I'm doing my dream job. So if I can give that to anybody else, then Go for it.
Well, we could carry on talking all day, I think, because I'm so fascinated in what you do. But if people are interested in your training, where do they go? How do they access it? Is it accessible to...
Yep. So, well, you'll find me on the internet. So I've got a website.
We'll put all your information in the footnotes.
Yeah, so just get in touch, and you can join my I deliver various types of training, so you know, professional level training if you're in the industry, or I do a lot of kind of engagement activities, so might give talks and stuff. So if you're interested in sort of getting a potted history of BPA, then you can probably come to one of the events that we run. So just get in touch, really, and we'll try and accommodate.
Great. Well, Jo, it's been an absolute pleasure and slightly gruesome at the same time, but thank you so much.
Not a problem. It's been good to chat to you.
Please listen next week for the third and final part of our mini-series, when I speak to Peter Dawson, Director at the Prison Reform Trust, about procedural justice within a prison context.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.